This is Embodied on the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Working from home looks a little different for sex workers. With many strip clubs closed and dancers excluded from larger pots of money in the coronavirus relief package, the sex trade has gone largely online. From strippers to erotic masseuses to full-service workers, virtual sex work requires innovation. While the growth of the adult platform OnlyFans has captured the public imagination, erotic content has long dominated the internet, and performers must fight to secure their image and their profits online. The battle over autonomy and image goes back to the days of camcorders and peep shows. To take us back to those early days when tech issues were analog, I'd like to welcome Antonia Crane to the program. She's a leader of Soldiers of Pole, a national sex worker union, and the author of Spent, a Memoir. She was also an employee at the former San Francisco strip club, The Lusty Lady. Hey, Antonia.
Hey, Anita, how are you?
Good, thank you. And just a note to our listeners, today's show will include a discussion of sex work and sexual coercion. So we're going to get deep into the sex work industry and look at it all the way from the past to the future. But I want to start with a great story that you have about the Lusty Lady in the 90s and kind of the entree gives us into concerns about privacy with regard to recording. So take us into that.
Sure. So 1992 is when I first started stripping, and I worked at the lap dance clubs, and also I worked at the Lusty Lady Peep Show in San Francisco, in North Beach, and it's a peep show behind glass. And we worked together on one big round red stage, and in the corner booths were private pleasures. Well, private pleasures around the corner. But behind the peep show, there was glass where we could not see the customers, but they could see us. And so this was the beginning of the World Wide Web, is what we called it, like the very beginning of the internet. And we just had no idea what it meant when customers were bringing in cameras and filming us in the corner booths where we couldn't see them. We couldn't see what they were doing. So I was on stage dancing next to the women that I always worked with. We clocked in like the old days, punching a time clock. So there was no doubt that we were employees. And one of the girls saw the red light and she said, "Move over, move over." And I was like, "What?" And she's like, "That they're filming us. They're filming you right there. Move over." And so we all like hid in the corner and she ran off stage. And she came back and said, "I'm going to change things around here." And so we had teachers and people who didn't tell their partners that they were sex workers. They weren't out as sex workers. And it was very violating and scary to imagine that people were recording us. In fact, we were completely nude. And so they were about, if your eyes were 3 inches away from your nether regions, completely bare, that's what was being filmed. And so it's hard to imagine, you know, Instagram, you put your image up all the time, like constantly. But back then, you're completely nude, and that was what they were filming, and we didn't know where that footage was going.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. Yeah, I want to pick up that story a little later on in the show, but kind of take you into a little bit of your backstory and get a sense of what the sex work industry was like at the time that you got into it and maybe what led you to get into sex work.
Well, everyone has their own genesis story of how they you know, entered the sex industry, but basically it's economic need. So back in the early 90s, I was studying post-structural feminist theory, black feminist thought, the civil rights movement. And it was considered performance art. It was just a viable way for really artistic, incredible, startlingly intelligent women to work together and perform. And so it was very much performance art. There was a lot of feminist performance art happening at the time, like Laurie Anderson and Karen Finley and Diamanda Galas, these incredible feminists. And so it was just sort of this viable option to go in. You could do your homework, do whatever you did during the day, paint, do whatever you wanted, and then at night go and leave with untaxed cash at that time. So it was just, it was considered performance art.
And at the time that you were working at the Lusty Lady, I mean, you mentioned some of the labor issues that you noticed and you experienced there, but there were a variety of other common issues that you saw at clubs. Could you paint the picture of what those issues were?
Of course. Well, of course, a big one was the racist hiring and firing policies. I mean, if you were a woman of color and you worked at one of the clubs, they would only hire those women if they were basically supermodels. It was incredibly racist. And also there was a lot of body shaming. So if you were flat-chested, you wouldn't be hired or given the shifts that you wanted. There was, I was on the ground working on Market Street in the clubs there. There were several. When the shift changed, when the tide changed to corporations buying all of the clubs, Deja Vu and Spearmint Rhino, just completely flattened Market Street, and then they began to extort us for something called a stage fee, which is just extortion.
And so when we use terms like sex workers and the sex trade, could you help people orient themselves to what we're talking about? What is the spectrum of work that is encompassed in these terms?
It's changed through the years, but sex work can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. It's the emotional and physical labor related to adult entertainment. So porn performers, that's a job that I haven't done, but it's the sex industry. Full service sex work is sex work. Stripping, although it is considered legal, is sex work. Phone sex is what also we were doing in the 90s. That's sex work. Now it's sugar babies and different things like that, OnlyFans. There's a lot, it's a huge umbrella term, and it's helpful that we all stand together as a workforce, which is why we call it all sex work, so that there's no what we call hierarchy.
Tell me what that is.
Stand together as a workforce. A hierarchy. Hierarchy. Just, you know, we, in order to come together as a coalition, which is necessary for our survival, to build a union and build unity and fight for our rights, we need to stand together. So like a pro-dom is a sex worker and so is a stripper. We have more in common than not. So it's better to just stand together instead of say, oh, well, she does this kind of sex work, so, you know, I'm better than her because I'm only this type of sex work. So we have found it helpful. And it's actually a 70s term. So this isn't a new term. But it's important for strippers and pro-dom dominatrixes to, like, say sex work, because we're all sex workers together fighting for better.
I'd love to have you...
So it really encompasses a lot of different kinds of work.
Yeah. Could you address the issue of choice and coercion in sex work and how blurred those lines can be and how you think people should think about how those come together within the world of sex work?
I've been dying for like 25 years for somebody to ask sex workers this question. So thank you so much for asking us. So sex work is something that I chose to do. I can only speak for myself, and I wanted to do it. And it was great money in San Francisco. As you know, it's one of the most expensive cities in the world. I could viably do it and set my own boundaries, my personal boundaries, physical, emotional. And so sex work is labor that we choose to do. Any sort of consent that enters the equation is, that is what we talk about when we talk about sex trafficking, is someone being coerced to do something that they are not choosing to do. And that's what I call a really bad situation. And the thing that people don't understand with sex trafficking is that sex workers know more about sex trafficking and what it is, and people don't seem to know what it is. Women are manipulated into situations that they don't want to be in because of economic need and lack of opportunity and, you know, circumstances in their lives that seem insurmountable, and they are taken advantage of and extorted and often abused. And the people that help those workers are sex workers. And I have personal stories about that. Maybe that's for another time, but when we're talking about sex trafficking, the law does not help sex workers. Cops do not help sex workers. Sex workers help sex workers. And we always have, and we always will.
I want to play a quick clip now that gets into this kind of blurred line and how those consent is navigated for people and how it looks different for different folks. So here's a clip from a sex worker based in Maine named Cinnamon Maxine.
When I did work alone, it happened a lot that I would see them once, maybe twice, and they would try to push my boundaries. I just wouldn't see that person anymore. And it always kind of hurt because I was really broke at the time, and I'm still broke. And I felt like sometimes I did have to push my boundaries to make money. And that always was pretty bad. when I felt like I was going into something that, like, this person's going to push my boundaries, how am I going to take care of myself? And sometimes I would have a driver, sometimes I wouldn't. And if I did have a driver and I felt things were getting close to scary, they were always just sitting outside.
That was Cinnamon Maxine, and I'm here with former sex worker Antonia Crane. I only have about 30 seconds, Antonia, but I'd love for you to respond to that clip and the blurred line that Cinnamon highlights.
That is a blurred line. I think that when we're talking about capitalism and exploitation and economic need and racism and all of these things together, everyone is going to have a different experience. I was drugged in a club by a customer, and this is what you see. I mean, our real lives are really the opposite of the movie Hustlers. It's the customers and managers that drug women. And these are things that happen on the shop floor because there's no protections in place and no security in place. And that's why we need to fight for better and get those protections in place.
All right. We're going to talk more about protections and unionizing and the fight for all of that as we continue this show. Antonia Crane will join us a bit later, author, former sex worker, and leaders of Soldiers of Pole. The conversation will continue on Embodied in just a minute, so please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Like a lot of other folks, sex workers are finding that remote work requires innovation and a lot of patience. Sites like OnlyFans and other subscription-based erotic services have grabbed headlines with their explosive growth this year. But sex has always fueled the internet. Sex workers have been a driving force behind creative solutions to privacy and profit. Today, we'll look at the ways their fight for a more efficient and safer technology is improving the internet for everyone. SX Noir joins me now. She's the Vice President of Women of Sex Tech and a podcaster. SX, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So I want to talk about how COVID-19 and this pandemic is reshaping the sex trade. So orient us to the world of online sex work and talk a bit about how the pandemic has changed that.
So I'm SX Noir, and I'm the thought leader of sex technology. I do a lot of work on the intersections of sex tech and sex work. And so when we talk about how sex technology and sex work have changed amidst COVID, we have to talk about, again, the resiliency and innovation that sex workers have in the digital space. What we have to also understand is that as of New York State, which is where I do my activism, sex workers were actively excluded from any government aid, any PPE, any kind of business fund. So if you are a stripper or someone who identifies with that form of labor, you were not eligible for unemployment. And so obviously there's a lot of loops to the system, but it's just a very blatant sex negative legislation that happens quite often in New York City.
Yeah, so the policies, the policies are sex negative, but I want to kind of orient people who don't even know what online sex work looks like to understand, you know, what is the landscape that we're talking about?
Yeah, so online sex work is any sex work that takes place in digital space. So this can be any kind of filming, conversation-based work, companionship-based work.
And has there been a huge uptick in that amidst the pandemic?
I believe that there's an increase in people attempting to have upward mobility in digital space due to the strain of capitalism in America. I think that people are attempting to navigate spaces that involve sexuality, like sex work in digital space, in ways that they've never had to before. We're finding that if you don't get unemployment, then you have to find ways to make money. And if you can't do it in person, then you will most likely navigate these third-party sites that have a very easy onboarding process that allow you to get directly in front of clients and customers to make money.
So OnlyFans has been the one that's gotten a lot of media attention in some ways because a lot of celebrities have joined the platform, other ways because a lot of new amateurs have joined the platform. I'm curious about how you think that, you know, it becoming more mainstream is changing what online sex work looks like.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that the sex tech industry is the basically the last untapped trillion-dollar market that tech market that hasn't evolved yet. And so the reality is that means new players and more people attempting to grab a piece of the pie. So we're seeing that there's more expansive opportunities in digital space for sex workers to make money. At the same time, we can also see that how they are criminalized and have extreme penalties and treated harshly. OnlyFans is a great site that has distributed a lot of money, but they also are incredibly whorephobic against in-person sex workers and all these different intersections of navigating the sex trade. So while we appreciate sites like OnlyFans, you know, I think my future that I'd like to see is women owning things and Black women owning things in digital space rather than men continuously making money off the tops of sex workers, which we're seeing happen in digital space the same we see it happen in physical space.
I would assume that something like OnlyFans, which is kind of a subscription model, does give folks more autonomy than, you know, a lot of in-person sex work where there's kind of someone at the top. Are you saying that that's not always the case?
Oh, absolutely not, because they're two completely different things we're talking about. You know, in-person work can have an incredible amount of autonomy depending on what aspect of the sex trade you're navigating. And so digital space does have its same privacy and security concerns, just like physical space, as far as staying safe, making money, and being able to navigate the have labor rights.
Got it. I want to get more into those privacy concerns in a minute, but first I'd like to welcome another guest to the program, Teddy B. Ruxpin. She's an online sex worker, burlesque dancer, writer, and organizer on the board of Soldiers of Pole. Hey, Teddy.
Hello.
So could you tell us a little bit about what your transition was like to working online? Before that, you were working as a dancer, you're working at a club, and then you moved online. What was that transition like?
So the transition was basically one of necessity. Because of the advent of the pandemic, the majority, well, all clubs shut down. And then, as SX mentioned, in a lot of states, also in California, the strippers were, if you were eligible for unemployment, because we had just recently been made employees, it really wasn't that much and it wasn't enough to live off of because we had not been paying into unemployment for many, many years because we were misclassified for a very long time. And so because of this, what happened specifically in Los Angeles was this interesting phenomenon of dancers began forming online versions of our clubs where we cut out the middleman and we went to our customers directly and we were like, well, if you want to see us, you can pay this amount of money for us to host a show on Zoom and then you can tip us and we will simulate the sex club environment online.
Did you have any fears about moving to that kind of online environment in terms of your ability to navigate privacy, your ability to kind of control the use of your image?
Yes and no. The thing is, working in real-life strip clubs, there is also that fear of violation of privacy. Like Antonia mentioned earlier, people love filming you non-consensually, and that happened a lot in strip clubs. And so therefore, kind of something you undertake when you start real-life sex work is you undertake the risk that no matter how careful you are and no matter what you do, it may eventually come to a point where your image is released and people find out. And so therefore, you kind of always weigh this risk of I may be outed at any time. I felt, though, like online, I was actually able to control that presence a little bit better because now I could screen who could see me and I could screen who is able to enter into my digital space. And therefore, if any leaks happened or if anything happened that was non-consensual, it was easier to figure out who had done it and to make sure that violation did not happen again.
Talk a bit more about that screening, because I think that's something that gets a little bit blurred when we look at kind of laws around managing tech platforms and laws around child pornography that end up bleeding into overseeing aspects of sex work, which is that your ability to screen is a really important part of your ability to feel safe doing your work online. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, so at least with the shows that I have done and the shows that I've been involved in, we do virtual ticket sales. And what that then allows us to do is to investigate and check everybody who's bought a ticket to the show, because you can't access or even see the shows without purchasing a ticket. And so therefore, I've been privy to a lot of conversations of people being like, hey, this person bought a ticket, but I don't really know about them. Or this person bought a ticket, but I don't particularly trust them. They were creepy in the club setting, therefore I don't think we should allow them into the space, et cetera. So we were kind of able to take a little bit more agency in who was allowed to see us versus being in the real life club where it was whoever could pay the door fee and walk into the door could enter into our space.
SX, I'd love for you to talk a bit more about that, because there has been a big national legislative focus on policing these online platforms because of a fear around trafficking and child pornography. And I'm curious about how those laws have impacted sex work for consensual sex work and not.
Yes, absolutely. So we have legislation that passed in 2018. In America have this history of sex negative legislation that uses sex workers as scapegoats because sex workers are considered criminalized people and are often have our unintended consequences in regards to legislation. So we have legislation like FOSTA SESTA that was an attempt to end child sex trafficking, but in reality, what it did was put a blanket of censorship over sexuality on the internet as an entire. And what that's done is it's impacted how sex workers were not only able to see clients, but also communicate with each other and share bad client lists. So this transcends into different kind of legislation like the Earn It Act, which just passed the Judiciary Committee. And the Earn It Act is an attempt to end encryption within digital space with an attempt to curb child exploitative material. And so we know, again, this is a psychological method used under the guise of sex in children to then impede on our First Amendment rights, which is we have the right to communicate privately with each other. And that's what encryption is. Encryption is a way of scrambling messages so that only you and the person you're sending to were able to decipher such messages. So when we see these inherently sex negative laws in America, it trickles down to, for example, strippers are not allowed to have Zoom shows, right? When corporate companies make these products, they inherently leave out sex, anything around sexuality. And so it impacts how you're able to screen and navigate your safety in digital space. And so that's definitely something that I really fight for, are these digital legislations that definitely impact sex workers and how they're able to not only make money, but stay safe and navigate safe labor practices.
What would it look like to create laws that supported sex workers in being able to feel safer online, but didn't encourage aspects of the illegal, I guess, child trafficking or trafficking or coercion?
We must decriminalize sex work in physical and digital space. That's something that I'm very adamant about. As of now, sex work is criminalized in digital space. This is through payment processors by performers having their PayPal stolen, having certain fintech just not accept anything that's alongside the terms of sex work. This is through socially with account deletion. That is actually, imagine having your Instagram for 10 years and all of a sudden it's deleted and all of those contacts and things that you've built are gone. And so when you decriminalize something, basically you don't criminalize someone for doing their work. And decriminalization takes away that element, which allows for sex workers to be able to do their work safer, to not need such protection as pimps, et cetera, and to be able to actually make a living without being continuously policed, harassed, and abused for just simply doing your job.
I want to play a clip from someone we spoke to who kind of looks at the opportunities that independent work can create. So here is a clip from Sarissa Sykes.
You have to learn to actually assess what you're worth and not kind of bend the rules, because there's a lot of people that'll try to pay less than whatever you're selling yourself for. And the hard part really is saying no, but it's just kind of part of doing business where you're not in control of everything and you have to be the one to tell somebody, sorry, no, this is what I charge, and just not sell yourself short. Learning how to tell people to leave you alone also when you're being sort of not harassed, but just kind of when someone doesn't learn, when you tell them like, no, I don't do this. No, I'm not changing this price, whatever it is. Kind of being the boss, I guess, at this point is the hard part. You don't have someone else to go to make it any easier. You have to be the one to tell them no, firmly.
That's Sarissa Sykes, an online sex worker on the East Coast. I'm talking with SX Noir, Vice President of Women of Sex Tech, and Teddy B. Ruxpin, a burlesque dancer and journalist. So, Teddy, I'd love to hear you reflect on that, navigating your boundaries, navigating what you do and don't want to do, and what that's like for you.
Sure. So I think especially when starting sex work, it's very, very important to set up boundaries, and it's very, very important to set up boundaries quickly. Sex work, like in all other kinds of work, can become a place where people try to get as much as they can from you, as cheap as they can from you, and as quickly as they can from you. And I think definitely a lesson I learned through dancing, because I was dancing
in the real life space for 5 years before I moved into the online space because of a pandemic, is that I had to learn that not all money is good money and not all money is worth it. And therefore, I had to learn to be able to go, hey, no, this isn't a situation I'm comfortable with, or this isn't something I'm comfortable doing, and therefore I will reject that. Because even in the real life space, what should be the protection of bouncers, managers, and owners oftentimes really falls short, because these people are also conceptually thinking of their bottom line, and you as a dancer are just the product that they're selling. And so therefore, your protection and your safety is not always their highest priority. And so therefore, it's important to take your protection underway. And then moving into the online space, that to me became even more important, because a violation of my boundaries could have consequences such as being outed, which for a lot of sex workers is the last possible thing they'd want to happen because of the societal stigma and the horophobia around being a sex worker. So I really agree with that clip. Oftentimes boundary setting is one of the hardest things you have to do as a sex worker, but one of the most important things that you have to do.
So obviously you're using a pseudonym. Aside from that, what other steps do you take to protect your privacy?
Aside from using a pseudonym, I use, for example, I have 2 different Instagram accounts. I have divided my social media presence between my dancer presence and my real life presence, which to me is really helpful, not only in the sense of security, but just in the sense of my personal boundaries and my personal safety, because Teddy is me, but Teddy is also a character. Teddy is the facet of me that does and performs sex work. And so therefore, in a lot of ways, Teddy and who I am in my daily life diverge on different points. And who I am in my daily life isn't always very sexy or sellable. And so I kind of like having a separate entity so I could put on to that is always fun and sexy and sellable and important. But besides separating my online presence, I also very carefully screen the people I talk to. In terms of communicating and selling work online, I typically work with people who I met in real life through the club space. So therefore, I've built years of client relations with them, and I understand them, and I understand our relationship.
SX, you've thought a lot about this because of your podcast and work that you do talking with sex workers and legal experts. And I'm curious about, you know, especially with concerns over stalking and online dating, you know, how are sex workers paving the way for how people should think about their image and their presence on the internet?
I love that question. You know, our generation, or not even our generation, our world right now has to have a duality that no generation has ever had to have before. We exist in both physical and digital space, privately and professionally. And so when we talk about just being a femme in digital space, period, we have to be watching our backs just like we kind of do in physical space. And so when it comes to privacy and security, inherently, these big tech platforms simply do not design and build for it, because they are not the people who are victims of harassment and abuse in digital space. Sidney Gallup makes this point, a sex technologist makes this point all the time, that white cis men who have founded and designed these big tech conglomerates are not the victims of harassment and abuse. Therefore, they don't design for it. And so this is what we're saying over and over. You know, if you're a bi POC, if you are queer, if you are just someone who is historically seen as undesirable by the white man, you most likely will have a difficult time navigating digital space. And so when we talk about privacy and we talk about security, these are not things to ask for. These are absolutely fundamental rights that we have. But unfortunately, in digital space, it's not seen that way. People are sold for the data that they collect and the data that they have, and sex workers uplift websites and build websites and then are kicked off of them once they're big and they have a lot of clout or money, right? And so these patterns we've seen historically, and they're not exempt in digital space. And what we are hoping for is for the future of technology is more women who are designing the technology they want to see, and therefore thinking and creating a safer space by designing for privacy and security.
SX Noir is the Vice President of Women of Sex Tech and the host of the Thought Leader podcast. You can find all of her information at our website. SX, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Teddy B. Ruxpin will stay with us just ahead as we return to the historic precedent of the Lusty Lady, a worker-owned strip club, as well as the move to decriminalize but not legalize sex work. But we're going to close out with a reflection on solidarity and how important that is for all workers in the industry. Please stay with us on The State of Things as we continue Embodied just ahead.
In the only a couple months that I've been doing this, I've had 4 or 5 fake sugar daddies in my direct messages, and I've had friends who have been scammed, or someone who tried to say, well, send me a few clips and I'll tell you if they're worth posting since you're new and you're not sure yet. There are Twitter accounts that are specifically for exposing sugar daddy scams. And there's a good chance that if somebody messages you and it seems kind of suspicious, you can Google their Twitter handle or whatever their username is, and someone might have already outed them as a scammer or a time waster. So it really is kind of a we have to look out for each other kind of thing, because if one of us is thriving, then that makes the chances better for everybody else.
This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Back in the 90s, a radical worker-led movement swept through San Francisco. Strippers were unionizing. The crowning jewel of the movement was a worker-owned cooperative, the Lusty Lady. Sim and Maxine worked at the Lusty Lady in the mid-2000s.
I absolutely 100% feel like because we were a union and cooperatively owned, there was extra space for us to understand and to care for each other. Without that, I don't think that a regular management viewpoint or style would have worked for us. Because we owned it and because it was cooperative and unionized, it really set us up to support each other in ways that other work environments don't do that.
I'm here with one of the leaders of the stripper unionization movement and a former worker at the Lusty Lady. She joined us earlier in the show and is back with us now, Antonia Crane, an author and a leader of Soldiers of Pole, a national organization working to decriminalize and unionize sex work. Antonia, welcome back.
Thank you. Hi.
And also still with us is writer, burlesque dancer, and organizer Teddy B. Ruxpin. So, Antonia, I want to pick up where we left off way earlier in the show when we were talking about your experiences at Lusty Lady. So you set up the scene for us about watching people take video of you without your consent and your movement to want to do things differently. You and other workers decided enough is enough. We need more control. We need more agency. So pick us up there and talk about the effort to unionize.
Correct. Great. Yeah, that pretty much says it. So when you work together in a small space, there's a lot of talking. And when you're commiserating with your workers, you realize that you all have similar concerns and different concerns. So with the filming us without our knowledge or consent was a huge thing we could all really stand against. We were all frightened of what that meant. So we had meetings. And back then it was answering machines and meeting in cafes. It was not cell phones or computers even. So we would meet in person at clubs. We would go see bands, meet together and talk, share meals. And the support staff was also, they were peers of ours. And so that's unusual as well. We would meet with our support staff. And when we said, hey, we want to get the one-way windows out, the one-way mirrors out of the dance area because we can't see what's happening in those rooms. Our support staff and some of the dancers said, there's no way, we're going to get fired. Mm. If we say anything, if we, you know, have this petition, if we circulate this and give it to the show manager and the director, we're going to be fired. There's no way. And then it just came up, you know, we need to unionize. That's the only way because it protects us as a workforce.
And you all work.
And so,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, and so then we had more meetings, and it took 2 years. And I think that's an important thing to say because it's great to strike, and it's great. All of the sex worker rebellions that are happening right now are vital and important and fantastic. But our labor war took 2 years.
And what changed the most once you all were unionized?
Well, everything changes because there's a big difference between just a regular employee or an independent contractor and a unionized employee. A unionized employee has protections in place and they have a union fighting for them, anything that they want, anything that they've negotiated in our contract. These are things that are in a contract. And so you have sick leave, sick pay, maternity leave, if that's what the dancers negotiate for. You have You can't just be fired randomly. There's a grievance policy. There's everything that you have negotiated for is protected. So it's not just something that some club manager texts you one day and then changes his mind in 3 seconds.
One of the biggest challenges for unionization efforts, and there's a lot of conversation going on about that right now, is that in a lot of strip clubs and for a lot of dancers and workers, they're classified as independent contractors, not employees. There's been some recent legal movement that may change the landscape a little bit, but take us into that. Take us into that distinction and how that has held a lot of sex workers back.
Absolutely. So strippers along the from C to C have been misclassified as independent contractors. And on July 31st, the National Labor Relations Board held that a stripper is an employee. And it's the first time ever that a stripper was given that the NLRB gave the right to unionize, even if her employer incorrectly classifies her as an independent contractor. And so this was Brandy Campbell, who runs a website called stripperlaborrights.com. And so she has the right to unionize with her coworkers, and every stripper does. So it may not have even been the ultimate outcome of that, of Brandy Campbell. That may not be what she was after, but it is a decision that is fact-specific. And it has to do with the amount of control the club exerts over the dancers, like in terms of like the rules, how they're set, how the dancers are paid. And so, you know, having the NLRB, which is a completely Trump-appointed institution, to have them rule in favor of dancers being able to build coalitions and unionize was really monumental.
I want to play a clip now from Cinnamon Maxine, who's talking about an experience in a non-union workplace, and have you both reflect on, I guess, how racial politics play out and the difference between being able to unionize in the face of managers like the kind that Cinnamon describes here. So let's listen to Cinnamon Maxine.
I worked at this house, and I got to work late, and the only other woman of color on staff was, you know, egging me on and wanting me to get ready really, 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 really fast. And I was kind of confused because there was other people sitting in the kitchen willing and ready to work, but she specifically wanted me. So like, I get dressed. When I get into the room, she starts doing race play without asking me first. And she tells the guy that I'm there to take payment on what he did to me and my ancestors. And it was very uncomfortable, and I didn't want to walk out because I was very young at the time, and I didn't think that that would – I was scared. So I did as much as she wanted me in the session, and I left. And I tried to talk to the headmistress of the house, and all she told me was, well, you know, she's black too. And I talked to some people in my community, and after that, I never went back. And my community was right there with me. They were like, yeah, that's weird. That was really unprofessional and should not have been dealt with that way. And from talking to my community, I did feel empowered to not work there anymore.
So that was Cinnamon Maxine. I'm here with writers and union organizers Antonia Crane and Teddy B. Ruxpin. So, Teddy, I'd love for you to reflect a bit on that clip and racial politics and racial dynamics in the sex trade and how those are navigated.
Yeah, sure. So that's a really interesting question, and I'm really glad you asked about it, because I think that's something that people don't think about or conceptualize in sex work. But sex work is an industry that runs very much on appearances, niches, and fetishes. And so therefore, kind of our societal biases and the isms and the things we've been taught by society are magnified in sex work and get played out across an even larger, broader scale. So you have it go from either side where either you're a fetish and that can be very dehumanizing, or it's a situation where clubs or other places don't want to hire you because they don't conceptualize you as desirable because they're thinking about what they can sell to the largest, broadest market they can. And typically that ends up being thin, cisgendered, blonde, white women. And so therefore, the racial dynamics in sex work become very, very complex and very, very interesting, because then you'll also have clubs who are majority monoracial. You have in Los Angeles, we had clubs who were like, oh, that's a black club. Oh, that's a white club. And so therefore, at these black clubs,
while the majority of the women who work there would be Black and the majority of your clientele would be Black, you would therefore also be expected to play into kind of stereotypical concepts of Blackness. So Black clubs would like play majority rap music, et cetera. And in white clubs, you would have the flip side where they would have maybe at most one or two women who were not white, a couple women who are women of color. And these women were typically always like supermodel level to be the exceptions to be allowed into these spaces. And especially as a dancer who is not only Black, but is also, for the benefit of radio, is heavily tattooed and has a good number of face piercings, it became very complicated for me to navigate these spaces and to find places I would be hired, because I did not fit comfortably into any niche, into the niches that people expected of Black dancers and the things that both management and customers expected you to play up to play into their fetishes, and also to the things that people expect of quote-unquote alternative dancers and the things that people expect you to play up in that aspect.
And there's similar kinds of fights going on for people along the gender and sexuality spectrum. We spoke with someone who talks about being a trans sex worker and what that experience of navigating their body in that environment is like. And I want to play a quick clip of that.
I think especially as a trans girl, I expected to deal with a lot more flack and a lot more transphobic behavior that hasn't honestly happened. And it's surprising because I've dealt with it in person working jobs from customers, from actual coworkers, but there's sort of an appreciation for women like me in this industry, and it's really oddly welcoming and exciting to not be guarded anymore about it. Whoever's there, they're there because they like either your personality, your body, whatever it is.
That's Cereza Sykes, an online sex worker on the East Coast. We're talking about the future of sex work today with burlesque dancer and writer Teddy Ruxpin and Antonia Crane, a writer and former sex worker. So, Antonia, how about the importance of unions in providing and supporting diverse workplaces for both people of the diversity of sexual and gender orientations and racial and ethnic backgrounds?
Right. Well, this is a huge and monumental turn, and it's very important, and it has been needed forever. So in navigating a future space, as Teddy and SX Noir were talking about these digital spaces that are really inclusive and where the dancers can be completely autonomous, as long as we're not being deplatformed, we need to build our own platforms and be able to like control our own bodies, set our own boundaries, and not keep our money and have an anti-discrimination policy that the dancers, that the sex workers have, that they all agree on and have that in place. And so I really feel like it's a really rich time right now. It's like a very fertile time to build new places and spaces to have sex work because, as Teddy and SX Noir were saying, the legislation that is largely coming out of the evangelical right and the fascist regime that is occupying the White House is about it's about criminalizing femme bodies, and it's about incarcerating sex workers and censoring femme bodies and controlling femme bodies. And so the way out of that is to create spaces where a collective, where dancers have an inclusive policy, where they have an anti-discrimination policy, where they have a collective where they know where the money is going. And when there's an interest in keeping the lights on and keeping the site going and operating it, they'll be invested and they'll want to like be involved. And it's just, it creates it's coalition building and community building. And it's really important. And I think it's actually happening.
As we close out the conversation, we've been talking about the future of sex work, the movement online, how things are changing, how folks are navigating privacy. But I'm curious about kind of your all's perspectives, about, you know, do you hope that sex work continues deep into the far future? There's kind of this argument that always splits feminism about whether sex work exists in an ideal world where everyone has ample access to opportunities and capital. Does sex work still exist, or is sex work a product of an inherently unequal society? So, Antonia, maybe we can start with you.
Anita, people are really jerking off 24/7, especially during the pandemic, and they're not going to stop anytime soon. And I think that there's some really exciting things happening in virtual spaces, and it's going to continue. And porn makes an incredible amount of money, and I think that the ownership and sex workers owning those spaces is really the key, and coalition building with other kinds of sex workers together and building unions and forming unions and really getting those contracts is going to change the tide, and it needs to desperately, and it needs to now. Sex work, that's a kind of a second wave feminism question, is just like, oh, maybe sex work shouldn't exist at all. Well, before any of us were born, sex work was happening. And there's always there's also a legacy of activism within the sex worker community. And so I don't believe that it should be abolished at all. I think that it's just going to grow and change.
Teddy, how about you?
Yeah, Anthony said this is a long argued question, both among feminists and both among people who conceptualize themselves as leftists. And I always find it kind of a weird question because, one, people always say that sex work is the oldest profession, and it is. It's been around as long as we've had any conception of money or trade. There has been the trading of sex or intimacy for money. Also, I think the question whether or not sex work will exist in the future is really the question of whether or not sex work can be consensual. Mm. Because if we can conceptualize all jobs as being in some way coercive under our current system, and therefore it's everybody selling their bodies for labor, then therefore how can we go, well, in a society where people don't need to sell their bodies for labor, they would still do what they would want, and they would still do these things and these things and these things, but for some reason nobody would want to do this. And I think honestly saying that is really archaic and goes back to these notions of no one is into sex work consensually. And if you're into sex work consensually, you're just being coerced and you don't realize that you're not doing it consensually and it's not what you would want to do. But in the future, in a future where you could do whatever you want, there would completely be people who would be like, well, what I want to do is sex work. If I was in a future personally where there were no constraints, no homophobia, I would love to continue dancing. I did it for 5 years. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had, one of the favorite jobs I've ever had. And so therefore, I think it's very reductive, anti-feminist, and anti-leftist to even conceptualize of a world without sex work, because you're removing the autonomy of sex workers completely.
Well, there we go. We have to close out the show right there. I think we can end it. Thank you so much to Teddy B. Ruxpin, a burlesque dancer, writer, and organizer on the board of Soldiers of Pole, and Antonia Crane, a leader at Soldiers of Pole, as well as an author and former sex worker. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm actually not a former sex worker. I'm still doing sex work.
Okay. We'll change your title. Antonia Crane, thank you so much. The State of Things, produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director, and Al Widarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.